Good morning. How's everybody? All right. Well, I'm thrilled to be with you this morning to talk about what's one of my favorite topics. Have no relationships to disclose, at least not at the moment. During my time with you, I'm going to try to talk a little bit about a conceptual framework for looking at policy change, and also try to share with you some examples of strategies and policy tools and how they might be used. One question I have for all of you, how many of you see policy change as a part of what you do? Okay, and how many of you see study of policy change as a part of what you do? Okay, so if there's anybody who didn't respond to one of those questions affirmatively, our task is to make sure you do not leave this room until we have caused you to take up the torch. It's an important one. We have a lot of work to do, and we need everyone on board. Okay, so as I'm sure you are all aware, in the not-so-distant future, much of aging-related policy was focused on old-age security. Okay, so it's only in recent years that we've shifted more to look at healthy and active aging. And I think a lot of the work that's been done to date has been done in other places in the world. And these are some excellent examples of initiatives done outside the U.S. And I'd recommend to you to look at them, because I think what's particularly compelling about all of these initiatives is that they represent nationwide efforts to create change. I'm not sure we quite have that here at home yet. But here at home, we do have a lot of exciting things going on that I think we can learn from in this important area of environmental policy change. Certainly, CDC's Healthy Communities Program, Active Living by Design, offer incredible lessons and resources for other communities. While neither of them is focused exclusively on healthy aging, they're still, I think, an incredibly valuable resource. Aside from that, and more specifically on aging, you know, we can look to programs like Kathy described, the EPA's award program. We can look to the work of the Atlanta Regional Commission and our two age-friendly cities, New York and Portland. Margaret back there, and as well as the work of groups like AARP, who I think are doing important translation work, if you will, by looking at complete streets policies and things of that nature, and trying to tease out the aging relevant pieces so that they can receive adequate attention. For our part in the Healthy Aging Research Network, we've invested about 2 years now in trying to do more thinking about environmental and policy change. And as a result, we've developed a bit of a do list, which you see here, expanding accessible housing, improving neighborhood and community design and safety, ensuring mobility and transportation options, protecting from hazards, all very basic kinds of things where we need development in order to ensure healthy aging in the future. To accomplish this work, we clearly need to build our capacity, both for in terms of knowledge of policy change and our ability to actually make that happen. And Bosch is going to be talking with you a little bit more about that shortly. So, when we think about policies that might help us accomplish these aims, it's clear that we have a lot of choices when we think about the policy arena. And the challenge, the dilemma, is how to choose the best of the lot, right? So this is what I'm going to be talking about a little bit with you today. You know, those of us in public health are ever mindful that change can take place at many levels, right? So we have federal, state, et cetera. And so one aspect of that making the best choice has to do with what level or levels we should be targeting for change, okay? and whether we should be focusing on risk reduction, that is, say, trying to, improve our poorly maintained sidewalks, or whether we should alternatively be focusing on enhancing opportunities, so creating parks that are more age-friendly. This is very difficult to see, but I think this is a useful exercise for folks, so I wanted to share it with you. In North Carolina, we're currently doing a lot of work on falls prevention policy and attempting to determine what policies might best be implemented at different levels. So down the left-hand side of this grid, we have the types of policy tools, kind of categories, if you will. And then what we've done is to, articulate specific policies that might be implemented at different levels. And this kind of becomes a beginning point for trying to study what the possibilities are and how to make the best choices. Here you can better see the types of policy tools down the left-hand side again, everything from law and regulation to inducements and sanctions and learning tools. Lots of good stuff in our repertoire of tools. And so with any of these, we can look not only at what makes sense, but also how likely it will be to have impact. And I think this is a really important question for us in the aging arena. Is the kind of change that we're talking about going to be transformative? That is to say, is it going to yield major system change in a relatively brief period of time? Or is it going to be more incremental, contributing very slowly to change over time? Will it be universal? Will it affect our entire population? Or more selective, reaching only people who are at risk? Will it be active, fastening our seat belts, or passive, like our airbags? Are we ready for the change? Is it a good fit? You know, there's quite a list of things that might be taken into consideration at looking at policy. So what I'd like to do now is go back to our do list and look at some of these policy themes, if you will, in terms of these criteria that I've just mentioned. Okay, so let's tackle accessible housing first. This is not an issue that we talk a great deal about in public health, but I think we need to change that. The unfortunate reality is that very few of us live in homes that would remain accessible to us in the face of disabling conditions, whether it's permanent or temporary. Outside of housing built with public funds, very few single-family homes have basic accessibility features, such as stepless entries, wider doorways, lever handles for those of us with osteoarthritis. There's one very entertaining study that puts the cost to add universal features to new construction at roughly $3,000, while the cost to go back after the fact and add these features is a whopping $60,000 to $85,000. So what are we waiting for? We have growing numbers of older people, and we don't have an adequate stock of accessible homes for people to live in. So this takes us to the issue of transformational or incremental change, and I think the case of inclusive home design ordinances is a great illustration of this. These are ordinances that require basic accessibility features, and for the most part, again, they've been implemented in publicly funded construction or as voluntary ordinances for single-family homes. Currently, only a handful of communities have mandatory ordinances for single-family homes, and Pima County, Arizona is one of these, and since the ordinance was enacted in the year 2000, they've built 30,000 accessible homes. Pretty impressive. It's even more impressive when you look at, from, again, the point perspective of mandatory versus voluntary ordinances. There was an excellent AARP study in 2008 that demonstrated that for every one home built under voluntary ordinance, 30 were built under a mandatory ordinance. So that's really something to think about. And our temptation is always to go with the incremental, give people a chance to get used to it. But, you know, again, it's worth thinking about. We have a choice here. All right, so the second item on our do list, which you've already talked about a great deal, is neighborhood and community design and maintenance. We're clearly in a time where there's a great deal of focus on these matters, and it's, you know, certainly extends well beyond aging into issues like childhood obesity, sedentary behavior. And I think part of our challenge in the aging sector is to find common cause with these other groups. We have, in many sense, a common mission. And yet, what we need to do is to ensure that the policies that are put in place do definitely take into account the particular needs of older adults. So most community design or redesign would fall under the area of policy change that is more universal. That is to say, everybody is affected by the excellent community redesign or whatever that's put in place, assuming that's community-wide. And of course, that's not always the case. One of my issues is always, in North Carolina, we have a senior-friendly communities program, and I always challenge people to say, well, is your community really senior-friendly for all of the older adults who live here? And if it's not, then how can you speak to that and say that, you know, you are senior-friendly? In some instances, though, we might argue that where we have a large and growing aging population, there might be justification to target some of our resources more selectively. So, for example, we might think about, and this kind of fits in a little bit with Bill's idea of environmental adaptation, but or at least more targeting, we might think about allocating improvement dollars first to places where that are sites of falls or pedestrian injuries. And oftentimes, those are parking lots or public spaces. We might also think about the business community. And really, that's an opportunity, I think, for policy change at an organizational level. In some places in North Carolina, we have a senior-friendly businesses program whereby businesses apply a set of criteria to improve both their policies and the environment of their businesses so that they can be more senior-friendly and better able to serve older adults. So Bill's raised again this issue of environmental modification versus accommodation. You know, environmental modification is clearly the more passive of the two, requiring little or no effort on the part of the population once it's put in place. And in that sense, it is a more upstream solution. I can't argue the merits of the two. We certainly need both. But at the same time, one of the things I think we need to think about is that, and Bill's kind of underscored this, is that the jury's still out on where all this change is taking us. You know, when we built suburbia, we thought it was a great idea, and we didn't realize there was a downside. But I think the really good news, and there are a lot of you here from academia, is that for those of you who are researchers, think about it. We have natural experiments taking place all across this country. But are we actually looking at those to see what happens and what the impact is on older adults who live in these communities? I think it's a great opportunity, and that it would also behoove us as a nation to commit some resources to studying the outcomes of these experiments. All right, and then quickly, next on our list, we have ensuring mobility and transport options. Clearly no small task, given that much of the planning and policy that occurs right now is done in silos. And we continue to pave sidewalks to nowhere, build highways without adequate consideration of ped bike needs, et cetera. So clearly we need a much more integrated approach there. And I think those of us who are concerned about aging, something we need to keep in mind is that the best mobility policies may be those that foster inclusion, okay? So if public transit is truly user-friendly for all, then older adults will be much more likely to have full access to their communities. If we're focused instead primarily on specialized transport, selectively targeting older adults, then almost by definition, because of limited resources, the older adults are going to have fewer choices. Something to think about. Kathy addressed protection from environmental hazards very nicely. I just like to point out here again the necessity to keep in mind the relatively greater vulnerability of older adults to air quality issues and similar matters. That's something that we need to continue to work on. And also the importance of thinking very broadly about hazards. I hope that everyone will take advantage of the opportunity to look at the Vancouver study by Marshall, which is really interesting in that it takes the concept of walkability, which for the most part has been, you know, very focused on land use and streetscape kinds of issues, and yet what is demonstrated in this study that in a number of so-called high walkable areas, there's also high air pollution. So it says, you know, that we're looking at the world through blinders and we need to get away from this to the extent that's possible. All right, and then lastly, we need to think about readiness and fit. Many a great idea has gone down the tubes because its time was not right. And clearly, also, you know, what's going to work here in urban Denver may not work in more rural areas of the state. And this continues, I think, to be an issue that so much of the work that we're doing is driven by work that's done in predominantly urban environments and does not translate well to small towns and rural communities. Okay, so that's about all I'm going to leave you with. Baj is going to be talking more about the issue of building capacity, which is very critical. But again, we have a lot of work to do. There are a lot of exciting things, I think, that have potential to help in terms of ensuring healthier aging in the future. So thank you for your time.